Well, we're continuing this morning in the book of Acts, so I invite you to turn, if you have a Bible, to Acts chapter 16. And our passage this morning is verses 35 to 40 of Acts chapter 16, so I'll just read those verses quickly. Acts 16:35, but when it was day, the magistrates sent the police, saying, "Let those men go." And the jailer reported these words to Paul, saying, "The magistrates are sent to let you go. Therefore come out now and go in peace." But Paul said to them, "They have beaten us publicly, uncondemned, men who are Roman citizens, and have thrown us into prison. And do they now throw us out secretly? No, let them come themselves and take us out." The police reported these words to the magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Roman citizens. So they came and apologized to them, and they took them out and asked them to leave the city. So they went out of the prison and visited Lydia. And when they had seen the brothers, they encouraged them and departed. So we encounter various characters then in this passage. We encounter the magistrates, the police, the jailer again, Lydia, the brothers, as they're tantalizingly referred to in verse 40, presumably others who have been converted during this trip to Philippi. But especially we encounter once again the Apostle Paul, and it's to him that I would like us to direct our attention this morning, and in particular then the fascinating complexity of this man, Paul. You can't reduce Paul to some very predictable set of adjectives. His character and emotions and behavior are much more nuanced than that. Things then which on the surface appear contradictory are in Paul held together in ways that are not actually contradictory. And I think we see that quite strikingly here in Acts 16. And I would like to highlight then four strands of this. So first of all then notice, Paul is peaceful, yet peeved. Paul is peaceful, yet peeved. So remember then in verses 22 to 24, Paul experienced this nasty ordeal there in Philippi. It's, I guess, not the worst bout of suffering that Paul ever experiences. He experiences a lot of suffering, but it's bad enough. How then does Paul react to that? How does he react to the treatment he receives there in verses 22 to 24? Well, it depends where you look. So you look at verse 25, and there Paul is peaceful. He's praying and singing hymns. He seems decidedly unperturbed by what he's just been through. But then on the other hand, you look at verse 37, and Paul is peeved. He's protesting vigorously. He seems decidedly perturbed by what he's been through. And so we need to ask the question then, well, how is this? Is Paul just emotionally unstable? Why does he seem to react one way in verse 25 and yet another way now here in verse 37? Well, I think it's because Paul then is conscious of two levels of reality. So first of all, on the one hand, he's conscious of God's activity. He's conscious of God's activity. Remember, we saw last time that this whole undesirable sequence of events in Philippi, the stalker, followed by the jail sentence, followed by the earthquake, that whole rather unpleasant sequence of events, it was actually God's means of converting that jailer. Now, Paul could not possibly have known that while he was in the midst of it, while he's there in those stocks in verse 25. He could not have known that God was in the process of converting that jailer. But Paul did know that God has ordained everything that ever happens, and that he has done so wisely and purposefully, so that no event is wasted and no event is fruitless, and that even then the wounding of his body and the violation of his dignity and the stripping of his freedom that he had experienced there in Philippi, it must be for the best. He knew that God wasn't panicking in the midst of this roller coaster ride that Paul was on. God wasn't there in heaven calling an emergency meeting of his angels. Look, guys, things are going desperately wrong down there in Philippi. Paul's mission trip to that city, it's all going pear-shaped. We need to do something here. We need to sort out this disaster. No, he knew that actually everything was going according to plan. That every last detail of his situation, down to the very wooden stocks that were chafing his ankles, every last detail conformed precisely to a plan that was eternal, unstoppable, and absolutely perfect in every way. So Paul is conscious of that. He's conscious of God's activity. And thinking about that makes him pray and sing there in verse 25. It fills him with peace that God is sovereign and is working out everything for the best. But then you see at another level, he's conscious too of the magistrate's activity. And governing authorities like them, he will later write there in Romans 13, are appointed by God. They are God's servants, as Peter will later write. They are sent by God to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good. The just God who loves justice has entrusted to figures like them the maintaining of justice in his world. This is a most noble, a most serious, a most dignified role that these magistrates perform. And yet here are these magistrates in Philippi, and they are utterly abusing that role. They're punishing a man who has done nothing wrong. And they're doing so not by some mistake. It's not that they've misinterpreted the evidence that's been presented them in court. No, they haven't even heard any evidence against Paul in court. He says in verse 37, uncondemned. We haven't been condemned. There's been no proper judicial process here. This is a flagrant abuse of their divine calling by these magistrates. And so Paul is conscious of that level too. He's conscious of the magistrate's activity. And thinking about that makes him protest and remonstrate. It gets him really peeved. And yet you see the remarkable thing with Paul here, and it's a little bit reminiscent of what we saw as we were looking at Jesus' emotional life a few weeks ago. The remarkable thing is that neither of these responses swallows up or engulfs the other. He holds them both at the same time. He isn't so peaceful in the knowledge of God's sovereignty that he can't see the offensiveness of the magistrate's abuses. But nor is he so peeved by the observation of the magistrate's abuses that he can't see the wonder of God's sovereignty. Both these realities are vivid and real to Paul. And I think then he's a model for us in this. You see, we should be peeved, shouldn't we, at times, by the inexcusable actions of human beings, rulers who use their positions of authority in order to line their own pockets. Christian ministers who use pulpits to poison their congregations with false teaching. Husbands who walk out on the wives and children who look to them for loving protection and provision. These things should peeve us. But you see, in the midst of these inexcusable actions, and even when we are the victims of them, as Paul was here, we should still at the same time feel that deep-seated peace that God is on the throne and from him and through him and to him are all things. A wonderful model then, emotionally, here in Paul, the way in which he is peaceful yet peeved. Secondly, notice, Paul is compliant yet confrontational. Paul is compliant yet confrontational. So I mean he's compliant then toward these magistrates that we've just been talking about. Now, of course, back in verses 22 to 24, Paul didn't really have any choice other than to be compliant to them. We have no evidence that Paul was some great hulk of a man physically, that he could have kind of taken on all these magistrates and the police and the crowd and the accusers, that he could have taken them on in some kind of fist fight. Paul probably had no choice. He couldn't resist them. He had to comply with what was going on there in verses 22 to 24. But then you jump to verse 34. And now the situation's quite different. He's now in a house where he's eating and drinking. All he needs to do now is walk out the front door of that house, and he's a free man. And there's nobody there at the door guarding him, and the jailer, whose house it is, he's Paul's friend, he's well and truly on Paul's side. All Paul needs to do is walk out the front door of that house, and he's a free man. And he can satisfy his conscience on two grounds. Number one, that it was a wrongful imprisonment in the first place. And number two, well, surely it's God's providence that there's been an earthquake and his chains have been loosed. And surely it's God almost inviting him to take his freedom. But remarkably, Paul doesn't take his freedom. In verse 36, we've had the magistrates send this message to the police. And the police relay it to the jailer. And the jailer says to Paul there in verse 36, come out now. Come out of what? Well, come out of your cell. Come out of the prison. Clearly, Paul, having spent that night in the jailer's house eating and drinking, he has now in the morning meekly returned to his prison cell. Earthquake or no earthquakes, Paul isn't going to take his freedom into his own hands. He is going to remain in that prison. He's been put there officially by the magistrates. He's not going anywhere until he's officially released. And it raises the question, why then? Well, he tells us in Romans 13:1, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. In verse 5 of the same chapter, one must be in subjection. And that doesn't mean then just one must be in subjection when the governing authorities are getting it right, when they're acting fairly and wisely and commendably. No, one must be in subjection. Full stop, Paul says. Now, of course, we know from elsewhere in the New Testament that there is an exception clause, that when the governing authorities are imposing commands or prohibitions upon me that are immoral, commands and prohibitions, obedience to which would leave me sinning against God, then I can't be in subjection. But that's not what is happening here in Philippi. These magistrates, they're not imposing any commands or prohibitions on Paul that will leave him sinning against God. They simply wrongfully jailed him. And there's no exception clause for that. It might be a nasty business being wrongfully jailed, but as far as Paul is concerned, it's still Romans 13:5 territory. One must be in subjection. So Paul's compliant. He doesn't try to run away, even when everything seems conducive to him running away. And he could construe providence in such a way that I'm supposed to run away. No, Paul will not run away. He's compliant toward the magistrates. But while compliant toward them, he's also confrontational. You see, we've seen, haven't we, that there in verse 37, Paul is peeved. But To whom is he talking there in verse 37? It's not a soliloquy. He's not talking to himself. He's not even talking to Silas. No, he's talking to the police in verse 37 so that the police can report what he's saying back to the magistrates. Paul is confronting the magistrates here. More than that, he's not just registering his protest to them. He's actually demanding some kind of redress. Let them come themselves and take us out. This is strong stuff that Paul is saying to them. So you see, for Paul, compliance doesn't mean keeping your head down. It doesn't mean some kind of helpless resignation. It doesn't mean simply being a pushover. He will not defy the governing authorities, but he will certainly expose them and challenge them and call them to account. And again, then, I think Paul is a good model for us in the way that he behaves here. Compliant, yet confrontational. Romans 13, 1-7 is a weighty passage, isn't it? It presents an extraordinarily high view of the governing authorities, to the point that not only is obedience demanded of us, not only are taxes demanded of us, but Paul even says respect. Respect is demanded of us. I wonder if you lost respect for David Cameron and his government. Do you feel that because they endorse same-sex marriage and they're suspicious of Christian schools, then you have the right to regard them as a bunch of idiots? You don't. They may get little respect from the pages of Private Eye. They may get little respect from the panelists on Have I Got News For You. But they are entitled to the respect of every Christian person in the land. It's a divine command. We must respect our rulers. So Romans 13, 1-7 is a weighty passage. It is meant to sober us, but it is not meant to silence us. It's not meant to turn us into spineless little citizens from whom the government will never hear so much as a peep. We can be Romans 13 people and yet still write strong emails to our members of parliament about proposed legislation. We can be Romans 13 people and yet still write newspaper articles and conduct TV interviews, shining a spotlight on government failures. Paul was a Romans 13 person. He wrote it. And yet he still taught robustly, still tackled robustly these authorities in Philippi here in Acts 16. Paul is compliant, yet confrontational. But then thirdly, notice, Paul is thorough, yet trusting. Paul is thorough, yet trusting. So we said then that in verse 37, Paul is peeved. We said that in verse 37, Paul is confrontational because he's not just speaking to himself, he's speaking to the authorities. But there's another dimension, isn't there, to his words in verse 37 that we haven't yet noted, namely this appeal to his Roman citizenship. And it raises the question then, why does he do that? Is it for the sheer pleasure of watching these magistrates squirm, watching them mortified as they realize that they've done all these things to a man who was actually of such high standing, a man who was actually a citizen of the empire? Does he just get some kind of kick out of seeing them put in that uncomfortable position? Well, no, I think he has a more substantial motive than that. He's thinking here of these brand new believers in Philippi. People like Lydia and the jailer and others. People who are going to remain in Philippi once he has long gone. And on the face of things, these believers are very vulnerable. The anti-Christian sentiment that had erupted so dramatically back in verse 19 it wasn't going to subside overnight. Those owners of that slave girl who blamed Paul and his little Christian movement for what had happened, they weren't just going to suddenly forget about their grievance. And the magistrates weren't going to spring to the defense of Christians in Philippi any more readily in the future than they had done then. Unless, that is, Paul can somehow get those magistrates on the end of a lead, as it were. Unless he can somehow put them in a position where it will actually be in their best interests to protect and defend the Christians in Philippi. Unless he can put those magistrates in a position where they will actually be scared of failing to protect the Christians in Philippi. And I think that's exactly what Paul is doing as he appeals here to his Roman citizenship. You see, it was no minor indiscretion that these magistrates had committed in treating Paul, a Roman citizen, the way they treated him. One writer comments, they could be deprived of office and disqualified from any further government service for having violated the rights of Roman citizens in a Roman colony. And you can appreciate then the useful leverage that Paul gains over these magistrates by suddenly flashing his Roman citizenship at them. You see, that now they know that Paul has the power to destroy their careers. All Paul has to do is go to their superiors and tell them what has happened on the streets of Philippi. And they'll be sunk. They'll be in serious trouble. And they know that. And so they're going to be desperate to keep on the right side of Paul. They'll stand up for Paul's Christian friends in Philippi, all right. They'll be 100% on their side. They won't do anything that might cause Lydia or the jailer to get on the phone to Paul and say, Paul, we're having a hard time from these magistrates in Philippi. They'll want to stop that from happening at all costs. And so you see, it's a brilliant move by Paul here to appeal to his Roman citizenship. It's so tactically astute. It's so strategically aware. He is being thorough here and doing all in his power to protect these new baby Christians in Philippi. But against that backdrop, I find it rather striking how low-key the final verse of this passage is. That here's Paul leaving these embryonic believers in Philippi, and okay, they're reasonably safe now from persecution because Paul has played the Roman citizen card. But persecution isn't the only threat they face, is it? What about false teaching? They don't have any great knowledge yet. What about disunity and division that just naturally is always a potential in the hearts of Christians? They're vulnerable. And you would have thought then that Paul would have put lots of other mechanisms in place. He's sorted out the persecution issue, but you'd have thought he would want to sort out the other dangers that they face as well. You'd have thought that he would appoint elders before going. That he would put mechanisms in place that will protect this church against all the different threats that it faces, but he doesn't. Perhaps he just simply hasn't got the time to do so. He's been asked to leave, verse 39. And we've said he's compliant to the magistrates. If they're asking him to leave, he will leave. Perhaps time is the issue, or perhaps for other reasons, perhaps in the circumstances, it's just not practicable to put in place any kind of mechanisms to protect these young believers. And so, as I say, it's a very low-key conclusion to the Philippian mission. They encouraged them and departed. That's all. Just a few words of encouragement. And with that, Paul has to walk away leaving those Christians in the hands of God, trusting the God who, as he will write in his letter to this church, the God who had begun a work among them, that he will bring that work to completion. And of course, we know that God did protect these Philippians, and that Paul was later able to write a letter to them. And by that stage, they are a well-established church, and they do have elders, and they have deacons, and they are partnering Paul in the gospel, and they're giving to him, and God did look after this church. But you see then this intriguing phenomenon here. There are things that Paul can do, and he does those things thoroughly. But at the same time, there are many things that he can't do, and he must simply trust God in the midst of his limitations. And again, it's the balance, the way he holds both these things together. Being thorough doesn't stop him being trusting, and being trusting doesn't stop him being thorough. And again, is that not a model for us? Are there not all kinds of situations in which it's applicable? Those of us who are preachers, there are things that we can do. We can study the scriptures. We can read the commentaries. We can work on our public speaking techniques. There are things that we could do, and we should be thorough in doing them. But at the same time, there's much that we can't do. We can't load our sermons with convicting, converting, life-transforming power. That's beyond us. We must simply look to God and be trusting amidst our own limitations. Those of us who are parents, there are things we can do. We can teach our children the truths of Scripture. We can discipline them carefully and relentlessly. We can expose them to the emptiness of this world's idols. There are things that we can do, and we must do them thoroughly. But at the same time, there is much that we can't do. We can't commandeer their hearts. We can't dictate their life choices. We must simply look to God and be trusting amidst our own limitations. Those of us who are concerned about opponents out there who would want to attack and to discredit NREC, there are things we can do. We can tick all the necessary boxes when it comes to health and safety and insurance policies and DBS checks. We can fine-tune our constitution in order to cover ourselves as best as possible. There are things we can do, and we must do them thoroughly. But at the same time, there's much that we can't do. We can't secure ourselves totally and infallibly against opponents, because at the end of the day, it's Satan who is behind all opponents, and he's stronger than we are. And so we must look to God and be trusting amidst our limitations. And so you get the point then. Christians are to be doers, taking our responsibilities seriously, but always in the context that, as we sang, the battle is the Lord's. Or to use theatrical instead of military imagery, we are just minor actors on God's stage. He's center stage. Indeed, as Paul will also say later in that Philippian letter, it's God who works in us, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Yes, we're thorough, but we're also trusting this big, omnipotent God of ours. Paul is thorough yet trusting. But then fourthly and finally, Paul is ready yet reluctant. Paul is ready yet reluctant. It's fascinating then, this business of Paul's Roman citizenship. Paul is a Roman citizen. He's not making this up. We don't know exactly how he came to be one. he was born one, we know. Maybe because his father or grandfather or someone had done something notable that had earned the approval and commendation and reward of the empire. We don't know, but for some reason then, Paul is a Roman citizen. And he is then ready to use that when it will be for the benefit of the church. We said that's what he's doing here. By playing his Roman citizen card, he is helping the embryonic believers in Philippi. And he'll do that once more, won't he, later on in Acts. In chapter 22, he'll again appeal to his Roman citizenship. So he's ready to do that when necessary. But it raises the question, why does he do it so infrequently? Why do we only know from two passages in Acts about Paul's Roman citizenship? I mean, this was a huge prestige in that first century world. You can see that there in chapter 22 from a conversation that a Roman tribune has with him. Verse 27, the tribune came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" And he said, "Yes." The tribune answered, "I bought this citizenship for a large sum." Paul said, "I am a citizen by birth." This man had paid a large sum of money for this. This was no empty honour. It wasn't like a knighthood in our society today. I mean, if Bruce Forsyth can be a knight, it kind of evacuates the whole thing of any meaning, doesn't it? It wasn't like that in the first century with Roman citizenship. This was something that was taken seriously, really seriously. And people then, if they were Roman citizens, others would know about it. They would make sure everyone knew that they were Roman citizens. They would parade this because it was such an honour. And yet here's Paul. On two occasions, he's ready to use it where it will help, where it will help the cause of Jesus Christ. But the rest of the time, he seems so reluctant to use it. Why is that? Well, I think the answer probably lies in that other passage that we read this morning in Philippians chapter 3, where Paul doesn't mention Roman citizenship. But what is clear in Philippians chapter 3 is that Paul is very, very wary of finding his identity in anything that is not Jesus Christ. Now there, of course, it's particularly his Jewish heritage that he's talking about, and that seems to arise out of the context. It seems from the early part of chapter 3 that there are some who have come to this church in Philippi and are troubling them with issues of circumcision and things like that. They're trying to some way make the Gentile believers in Philippi more Jewish. And so Paul therefore talks about his own Jewish background, his own Jewish heritage, and how though he could boast about this, and though he can tick every single box when it comes to Jewishness, yet he says, "I count it loss. It's nothing to me, because I find my identity now in Jesus Christ." And of course, what Paul's Jewishness could have been to him, Roman citizenship was to many people, and could also have been to Paul, because he was a Roman citizen as well as a Jew. And Paul is wary then of anything that becomes his identity. "I'm Paul, a Roman citizen." He's wary of that. He wants to ground his identity in Jesus Christ and in nothing else. Now, I've said then with our first 3 points this morning that kind of both sides of the tension, the peacefulness and the peevedness, the compliance and the confrontationalism, the thoroughness and the trust, that both sides are good models for us. With this last one, it's particularly the reluctance that I just want to close applying to ourselves. Paul's readiness to use this Roman citizenship where necessary. It's perhaps difficult to make any direct applications of that to ourselves, although I'm sure we could make some indirect ones. But let's just think about this reluctance, his reluctance to ground his identity or come close to grounding his identity in anything that is not Jesus Christ. Surely there's application in that for us this morning who are Christians. How easily we can come, can't we, to ground our identity in other things. Might be our income. There's nothing wrong with having a big income. But if that becomes the lens through which I see myself, I am Joe Bloggs who earns this much money, then that's a problem. Might be our gifts. Nothing wrong with being gifted. God is the one who gives us those gifts. But again, if that's how I see myself, I am Joe Bloggs and I'm conspicuously gifted in this area, that's a problem. Might be our sporting accomplishments. Might be our intellectual, educational achievements. It could be anything. But for the Christian then, this is the bottom line. Philippians 3:8, I count everything as loss. I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. All those other things, my job, my income, my gifts, my abilities, my accomplishments, they're just footnotes as to who I am. They're just minor details about me, throwaway facts about me. The great thing about me, the thing that defines who I am, is that I know Jesus Christ and I possess him and I'm united to him. That's the stance of a Christian. And so if you feel that other identities are creeping in, then like Paul, be wary. Be reluctant to go there and come back to Philippians 3:8. Amen.